My apologies. Good afternoon. My name is Paul Fishman. I'm a partner at Arnold & Porter. I'm joined here today by my colleague, Mitra Hormozi of the law firm of Walden, Macht & Haran, as well as Rita Glavin of Glavin PLLC. Ms. Hormozi and I represent the executive chamber of the state of New York, and Ms. Glavin represents the governor of New York in connection with the attorney general's investigation of the allegations of sexual harassment. And we're here today to talk a little bit about that investigation. So let me start first by explaining the idea of Ms. Hormozi and I representing the executive chamber of the state of New York. Those of you who cover Albany and the governor's office know that that's a fancy and slightly old-fashioned way of saying the office of the governor. We don't represent the governor personally. Ms. Glavin and her colleagues do. In March, as you all know, the governor referred to the Attorney General of New York a request that she select an independent law firm to investigate allegations of sexual harassment and the surrounding circumstances. About a week or 10 days later, Ms. Hormozi and I and our law firms, of course, were engaged to represent the executive chamber. And our role is actually pretty simple to understand, I think. Our first our first goal and our first purpose was to make sure that the investigators got all of the information and all of the documents, whether they were hard copy and electronic, that they were entitled to. And as you might imagine, that involved a pretty massive production over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, an enormous number of hard copy and electronic documents. And the second part of our task was to represent chamber employees if they didn't choose other counsel, who wanted us to accompany them to the interviews that were requested by the investigators. And the third was to make sure that the chamber and its employees were treated fairly. And it's the last of those things that I want to address briefly. As you know, the special deputies on behalf of the Attorney General issued a 165-page report on Tuesday at 11 o'clock. As you all know, this is not like an ordinary civil or criminal proceeding. Their report will not be followed by a civil hearing or a criminal or a trial to determine the accuracy of their conclusions, how they got there, or to weigh the evidence. For the people in the chamber, this was the end of the line. This was for what the Attorney General and the investigators meant to have as effectively the first and last word. As a result, a few weeks ago, we asked the Attorney General's office to provide the people whose conduct would be discussed, the conduct that would be evaluated, and as you now know, the conduct that would be criticized. We asked for them to provide draft copies of those reports to the people whose conduct was really implicated by their findings. And we asked them to do that because we had concerns, as people would in any circumstance like this, that there might be things that were inaccurate, there might be things that were not sufficiently thorough, there were things that might be included or excluded from the report that might be fair or unfair. And we wanted to make sure that the people who were going to be discussed had an opportunity to respond before the report was made public. In the end, the Attorney General's office refused that request. And everyone in the chamber, from the secretaries to the governor, who were discussed in that report, got that report at exactly the same time as those of you in the press did and as you, the members of the public, did. And that was problematic because their opportunity to challenge, to rebut, to raise questions did not occur until after the report was public. And in today's media world, with its 24/7, all of those allegations were out and being reported while people were first flipping open the pages. Our request was not an unusual one. It turns out that it is really a commonplace occurrence in these kinds of investigations. It's state of the art, really, for investigators to provide that sort of information ahead of time to people who are being investigated. The Department of Justice Office of the Inspector General does it. The GAO does it. The New York Inspector General does it. Most if not all inspectors general in Washington do it. And they do it because they want to make sure that they're being fair to the people who are being investigated, but they also want to do it for themselves and for the public to make sure that the report is accurate. That did not happen. And as a result, it's now taken some time, and you'll hear from Ms. Glavin in a little bit about things that relate to the governor in particular, but it's taken some time for people to sort through the report and to see what they might think is actually not correct. So I'll give you one example today, which is one that got some press yesterday and the days before. And it's the one really in which the special investigators take issue in particular with the activities of the chamber as a whole, by the group of senior employees as a whole. And that's with respect to the allegations that were raised by Ms. Boylan last December and when she started tweeting about the governor as a sexual harasser. And as the report makes clear, the governor's office, the chamber, did two things. One, released some records that related to the circumstances of Ms. Boylan's departure from the chamber. And the second was to consider and ultimately decide not to publish either an op-ed or a letter regarding Ms. Boylan or about the governor. The reason that's important is we had a very strong sense from the questioning of various witnesses, and we represented 20 some odd employees ourselves, between Ms. Hormozi's firms and mine, but we had a sense of the kinds of document requests that they were making, that they were investigating whether that conduct was effectively illegal retaliation against Ms. Boylan. And we wrote a 13-page letter, almost a brief actually, to the Attorney General's office explaining why that conduct did not meet the legal definition of retaliation. I understand that the Attorney General's office reached a different conclusion, and they're perfectly free to do that. That's what happens when lawyers go head to head and talk about the factual and legal analysis that's around a particular circumstance. But what disturbed us about the report is that that letter got, was A, mischaracterized, and then B, effectively given the back of its hand in a footnote. Why is that important? It's not our egos. Our egos are not bruised by that. What matters is that there is a very serious legal issue about whether the Attorney General's office is correct or not. And that serious legal issue should have gotten more consideration in a report that reaches a conclusion about illegality. And that's, so that's one example. There will be others that relate to the governor personally that Ms. Glavin will discuss, I understand. The second thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of fairness is in terms of the transcripts. Many witnesses testified. Many of them were chamber employees. Many of them were interviewed without court reporters. Many of them were interviewed with court reporters. It is now 76 hours since the Attorney General's press conference. Not one of those witnesses and not one of their lawyers has a copy of the transcript, as we understand it, of their own client's interview. Nobody. The assembly seems to be getting them. District attorneys seem to be getting them, but the witnesses who still want to look and see whether their testimony was recorded accurately, whether the question was right or wrong, and even the public who might want to see how the questions were phrased, what the evidence actually is, does not yet have a copy to see that. And that's a particular problem for the people whose conduct was being questioned. It's also a particular problem for the governor and the chamber as we respond to that report, because it's, as you can imagine, as lawyers, what we like to do, what we need to do, what we're entitled to do on behalf of our clients is to see the evidence so that we can properly respond to it. But right now we can't. And so my one ask, it's too late to fix getting the report before it comes out. It's not too late to get the transcripts. And so whether it's the Attorney General's office or the assembly, who now has the power and the authority to release those transcripts to the lawyers of the witnesses who testified and to Ms. Glavin so she can prepare her response on behalf of the governor. That's the last thing that I think we need to think about, is whether it is now time for those transcripts to be turned over so that the lawyers representing their clients can now finally respond on behalf of their clients as you, the press, you, the public, and people want to hear. So now, Ms. Glavin, I turn it over to you. Ms. Glavin, I believe you're on mute.
Sorry about that. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rita Glavin, and I represent Governor Cuomo. I'm a former federal prosecutor, and I know the difference between putting together a case against a target versus doing independent fact-finding with an open mind. There has been no open-minded fact-finding here. In this investigation. This investigation was conducted in a manner to support a predetermined narrative. Am I frozen? Okay. Good afternoon. I apologize in advance for the technical, or actually I apologize after the fact for the technical difficulties. Our Ethernet went down. But I'll start from the beginning. My name is Rita Glavin, and I represent Governor Cuomo. I'm a former federal prosecutor, and I know the difference between putting a case together against a target versus doing independent fact finding with an open mind. And there has been no open-minded fact finding in this case. The investigation was conducted to support a predetermined narrative. In our legal system, both sides are heard and given access to the evidence. But here, instead of acting as independent fact finders, the investigators acted as prosecutors, judge, and jury. On Tuesday, the Attorney General and the investigators called a press conference. And within minutes of that very carefully choreographed press conference, there were calls for the governor to step down. We weren't given, as Mr. Fishman told you, any advance notice about when the report would be released, its findings, a chance to respond to errors, inaccuracies, and that was intentional. This was not an exercise in truth finding. Let me tell you that on just our review of the report, and again, as Mr. Fishman informed you, we do not have the underlying evidence that has not been provided to us from that report. We have not had a chance to examine the transcripts or even memos of interview of the 179 people that the Attorney General interviewed. But what I do know, based on the limited information we've been given access to, there are contrary facts and omissions from that report. And you have to ask yourselves why. I'm going to give you three examples. The first relates to executive assistant number one. What she has alleged is perhaps the most significant allegation made against the governor. She has said that during the work day, the governor groped her breast in his office. In essence, she has accused Governor Cuomo of sexual assault. The governor has repeatedly denied that ever took place. And quite frankly, when she first raised this in early March, he was stunned. This executive assistant gave an anonymous interview to the Albany Times Union. It was published on April 7 of 2021, and I encourage you, please, read what she told the Times Union about that day. She told them that she was asked to come to the mansion to fix a technical issue with the governor's iPhone or with his phone. And the report states as fact that she was summoned to the mansion. What she tells the Times Union is that she walked into the governor's second floor office, where he slammed the door, groped her breast under her shirt and over her bra, and then she left without saying a word because she was so upset. The governor was interviewed on July 17th. And during that interview, he was told for the first time when this alleged incident took place, November 16th of 2020. And after that interview, I did, as the governor's lawyer, what I would have expected that the investigators had already done. I did what any investigator would do, which is I reconstructed the events of that day. Me and my team went through the emails for that day, all the entrance and exit records, and this woman's story, which is stated as fact in the report, is false. The documentary evidence does not support what she said. And what is disturbing to me is that the two investigators did not show that evidence to you. They ignored it. Ask them why. Let's go through the timeline of November 16th, okay? In her account to the Albany Times Union, she says she was summoned there from the Capitol to the mansion to fix a phone issue. She arrived, she went to the governor's office. He came out from behind his desk, that he groped her. And there was the door slamming. And he said, I don't care, when she said, someone's going to see us. And then she walked out and left. Well, that's not what happened. She was at the mansion that day for several hours. She wasn't just working with the governor, she was working with other staffers. Emails that she sent while she was at the mansion reflect that she was joking while she was there. She was eating snacks. And she even offered to stay longer at the mansion when her work was done. Here is the timeline that the investigators don't talk about. She arrived at the mansion at 11:59. Within 5-6 minutes after she's there, she's forwarded a speech, okay, from Stephanie Benton, who was also in the mansion that day. She was there to work on a speech, not to fix a phone. And over the next hour or two, the governor was on phone calls with other governors, and he was preparing for a 2 o'clock phone call with governors and the vice president of the United States about COVID. And he had a series of scheduled calls with governors in connection with that. At 1:59 p.m., she sends an email to Miss Kennedy, who was at the Capitol, another assistant, and said, Steph said, never mind, Harold fixed it. At 2:09 p.m., while the governor is participating in a 30-minute governor's call with the vice president, she emails the draft speech that she'd been working on back to Miss Benton. And then that speech was forwarded to senior staff. At 2:16, Miss Kennedy emails her and asks how it was going at the mansion. And her response at 2:18 p.m., pretty good right now, actually. Carol just came through with some cheese and crackers, so I'm happy now. Carol is a member of the mansion staff. And where Carol serves cheese and crackers is not on the second floor of the governor's offices, it's on the first. And when she emails about getting the cheese and the crackers, Miss Kennedy replies back, you gotta love the cheese. At 2:37, Executive Assistant One then emails Miss Benton again, and she says, hey, the gov just came in, said he was good. You need me to do anything else for you before I head back to the Cap? What that email reflects when it says the governor just came in, there is an office on the first floor of the mansion where the governor's assistants work when they are there. That email reflects that the governor came into that office to say he was good. Didn't need anything else. And then she emails Stephanie Benton to say, is there anything else that you need me to do here before I head back? The governor then was on a phone call with his chief of staff, and Executive Assistant One left the mansion at 2:47. This does not, in any way, shape, or form, reflect what Executive One told the Times Union. And again, I ask, why did this report ignore documentary evidence, and why did they not want to tell you? The report instead suggests that the governor falsely testified that there were people around, that he said to touch a woman's breast, who I hardly knew, in the mansion with 10 staff around. And what the report said, there wasn't evidence that there were 10 mansion staff around in the vicinity of his second floor office that day. Well, the report's wrong. Records reflect that senior staff members were in the mansion working with the governor that day while Executive Assistant One was there. Pete Jaminian, Stephanie Benton, Melissa DeRosa, the House staff, as you know, Carol. Carol's usually there with one or two others. There were actually staffers that came in and left to drop something off. Did the investigators ever ask those senior staffers about November 16th? Ask them. Ask the attorney general. Release the transcripts. Because I'm betting they didn't. It would have taken 5 minutes for the attorney general's investigators to send a subpoena asking for all emails and records for November 16th, and they didn't do it. You got to ask yourselves why and what this report was designed to do and to not do. When Executive Assistant One claims the governor slammed his door, if you're to ask anybody who works in the mansion, because of the age of the mansion, a door being slammed shut echoes. The report doesn't say that anyone corroborated hearing a door slammed, because the fact that the Executive Assistant One was in the mansion that day, that's not an often thing that happens during the workday, that Executive Assistant One is in the mansion for several hours. Did the investigators even ask any of the people who were there that day? Ask them. I'm gonna go to the second example. Statements that undermined Lindsay Boylan's claims were ignored in this report. On December 5th, and this is where this all started, with tweets from Lindsay Boylan. On December 5th, she tweeted, now this is 2 weeks. You have to consider the timing of when these tweets started. She had announced about 2 weeks earlier that she was running to be the Manhattan Borough president. So she knew that her tweets at that time were all going to be within her campaign and the platform that she was going to run on. And what she said was she tried to quit 3 times from the governor's office before it stuck. She said, I'm a privileged person. I could opt out and eventually did. And what she was clearly trying to tell the world is that she opted out because of a toxic work environment that she was being sexually harassed. Well, the evidence is not that that's why Ms. Boylan left. As has been, you know, reported. What happened is that on September 26th of 2018, the governor's council met with Ms. Boylan. And the reason for the meeting is that there had been a number of employee complaints about her. The Attorney General's report omits what those allegations were, what was said about Ms. Boylan, what the recommendation was from the Empire State Development Agency. Why? Why didn't they put that in there? When Ms. Boylan was confronted with a number of complaints, she immediately and voluntarily tendered her resignation. She then sent an email throughout the chamber. She was resigning. We want to know what happened 4 days later. She called the governor's council and said she wanted her job back. The governor's office declined to give her her job back. She then reached out to the governor to personally intervene. She emailed his assistant, asked to speak with him. He didn't return her call after consulting with a number of people. Why didn't the investigators put this in their report? Particularly when 2 weeks after she started her campaign, she was leading the public to believe a false story that she left because of sexual harassment and a bad work environment, when in fact she left after being confronted with a number of complaints and then really wanted her job back and they wouldn't give it back. The fact that this is not in the report goes to Ms. Boylan's credibility, and it goes to the credibility of the investigators and their investigation and their fact finding. I want to make a last point, the third point. After Ms. Boylan began tweeting in December of 2020, there were phone conversations between Ms. Boylan's primary campaign consultant, a person by the name of Trip Yang, and Letitia James's chief of staff, Ibrahim Khan. Those conversations were about what Ms. Boylan was tweeting about and her intent with respect to the allegation she was going to be making against the governor and what she potentially planned to do. And Trip Yang is having conversations with Ibrahim Khan because they know each other. Letitia James's chief of staff worked with Trip Yang because he was a consultant to her 2018 Attorney General campaign. The investigators were made aware of what those conversations happened. Did the two investigators interview the Attorney General's chief of staff about what Trip Yang had said that would have been something critical for them to do, and about whether Trip Yang and people within the campaign found what Ms. Boylan was saying to be credible? One of her media campaign consultants, very shortly after she began making these tweets, quit. Did they interview the media consultant about what her conversations were with Lindsay Boylan about these allegations? Ask them what Ms. Boylan was talking about at the time she first made these allegations could not be more relevant to whether they were credible. The Attorney General's chief of staff should be interviewed. Trip Yang should be interviewed. The media consultant should be interviewed. And emails from the campaign around that time should be subpoenaed. I want to go to my last point about the report, and my last point for now. There was a claim by Ms. Boylan made for the first time on February 24th in a Medium piece, that she got on to the state airplane where the governor and other staffers were. And what she said is that she was sitting across from the governor, and this is a pretty small plane, next to a woman named Abby Collins. And what she said was that at one point that the governor said something to the effect of, "Let's play strip poker." Well, Miss Collins, Danny Lieber, John Maggiore, and Howard Zemsky, they were on all flights with both Miss Boylan and the governor in October of 2017. And they stated that this conversation did not happen. Okay. What does the report say? The report says that after denying having heard this strip poker comment, Howard Zemsky, quote, this is what the report says, received a disparaging message from Miss Boylan that he found, quote, jarring, end quote, and threatening. After getting the jarring and threatening communication from Miss Boylan, Mr. Zemsky's recollection then suddenly changed. Why did the report not share what the message was? What did Miss Boylan threaten Mr. Zemsky with that would have caused him to change his story? Why is that not in there? Why does the report discredit all of the other witnesses who were there and then suddenly credit the one witness who had been threatened by Lindsay Boylan before his recollection changed? Did the investigators ignore that message? Did the investigators look into whether Lindsay Boylan was making efforts to influence the testimony of other witnesses? Because the report mentions that she was reaching out to other people. Why is the message not been shared? The governor has been asked by the Judiciary Committee of the Assembly to get a response of any evidence or arguments that he has by August 13th. And we intend to do that. But what we have asked for and are entitled to is the evidence. We're entitled to get the transcripts, the underlying documents that support that report, because what we know is that they have left material out. And I will share with you that I received a phone call a few months ago from a lawyer. And this was a lawyer that I did not know. I didn't know was involved in the case and represented someone who I didn't even know had been interviewed. But this lawyer got my telephone number through another lawyer because this lawyer believed that it was very important for me to get some information. And the information was that the manner of questioning alarmed this lawyer, that I was being warned that minds were made up and that questions pushed back on evidence that was favorable to the governor, and particularly information this witness had to provide about credibility. The governor deserves to be treated fairly, and he must be. That did not happen here. This was one-sided, and he was ambushed. There's a rule of law in this country. I believe in it. give us the opportunity to have the evidence, and we're going to give our response. Thank you.
I believe we're taking questions, but I don't know what the mechanics of that are going to be.
If you'd like to ask a question, please use the raise hand function at the bottom of your window. We'll just take a brief moment to compile the Q&A roster. First question comes from Marcia Kramer, WCBS-TV. Marcia, you are unmuted.
Yes, my question to you is this. Do you think that there was any problems in terms of the integrity of the prosecutors who were involved? Some of them, including Mr. Kim, had prior investigations of people in the Cuomo administration and even the governor himself. Do you think that that prejudiced him, or was the governor given a fair hearing when he was questioned by him?
Let me answer the first part of that question, and then I'll let Ms. Glavin answer the second part of this question. I've known Mr. Kim for a pretty long time, and I'm loath to criticize people I know who are members who are very highly regarded members of the bar. But you are correct that Mr. Kim was involved in his last position in the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office in two grand jury investigations that involved the Cuomo administration. And in one of those investigations, he personally interviewed the governor. I wasn't at those interviews. I was in my old job as the U.S. Attorney in New Jersey at the time. And so I don't know exactly what transpired in that interview. And then the governor has relayed that he complained about the assistant U.S. Attorney and the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District to the White House at some point. I obviously was not part of that conversation either, but the governor does have concerns, very serious concerns, about whether Mr. Kim was the independent investigator that the Attorney General promised she would appoint in this matter. But Ms. Glavin may have additional thoughts.
Marcia, I actually think the best way for you to think about this, about the appointment of Mr. Kim to investigate sexual harassment allegations of Governor Cuomo, is for me to give you an analogy to Mr. Fishman. As you all probably know, Paul Fishman was the U.S. attorney in New Jersey who had a longstanding investigation of Governor Christie in Bridgegate. What do you think would be the propriety if now fast forward 5-6 years later, Governor Christie was accused of sexual harassment allegations, of appointing Paul Fishman to be the one to do that? Does that lend to you a feeling that it would be truly independent fact-finding? The best I can tell you on this point is that Mr. Kim was part of an investigation of the governor and people around him for a number of years about the closing of the Moreland Commission. And then certainly with respect to the prosecution of Joe Prococo. And there's no question in my mind that he formed impressions about how the chamber was run. And you can look for yourself at some of the comments that Mr. Kim and Mr. Barrera, his boss, Mr. Kim was the number two, made about Governor Cuomo and how things were run in Albany during that time. So you look at that. And then I can't, as the governor's counsel, I can't ignore how the investigation was conducted. I think that different lawyers may have done some things differently. And I'll leave it at that.
Your next question comes from Jimmy Vilkind of the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Vilkind, your line is now open. Please unmute your microphone.
Hi, a woman identified as Trooper Number One alleges that the governor ran his finger down her spine and said, "Hey, you." And in another instance, he touched her stomach from her belly button over to the portion of her hip where she carries her gun. Do any of you have any response to those allegations? I haven't seen any in any of your written materials or statements thus far.
I want to mention two things about that. The first is that the governor will address that allegation himself, and so I will let him speak for himself when he
does.
When
will he do that?
I can't give you a timeline, but I know he wants to do it soon. But there is something I want to point out. The report suggested that the governor singled her out, and wanted her on the detail because of some improper motive. That's the clear suggestion in the report. And what the governor told the investigators in his testimony is that he had been complaining about the lack of diversity on his detail for some period of time. He has about 60 troopers that are on the detail. There's only a handful of women. And for a governor who has hired and has senior women in all of his top jobs, this had bothered him for some period of time, and he voiced it. And as the governor related to the investigators, he had met this trooper. He thought she was impressive in their meeting. And he said, "I don't understand. Like, why can't we hire somebody like her? Do you know her?" And he was told she was excellent. So why don't we hire her?
Can you explain what led the governor, based on an interaction at an event, to believe that she was impressive?
He liked how she maintained eye contact. He liked that she was assertive with him in the conversation. And then he asked one of the troopers he knows about her, and they said, "Yeah, she's excellent." And he's like, "I don't understand this. Why do I not have women on my detail?" There's also a suggestion that the governor went and wanted to change whatever the qualifications were. The governor had said he did not do this. I don't know what happened, within the detail, but and within the troopers and what their internal policies are. And actually, the governor told the investigators he did not know. But he certainly, if he meets someone, particularly in the trooper world, and he wants diversity, and he has said that to them, that he wants that. So I did want to make that point, because he made that in his testimony, and it certainly was not reflected in how the investigators chose to report that.
Your next question comes from Michael Gormley, Newsday. Mr. Gormley, your line is now open. Please unmute your microphone.
Yes, you mentioned that the questioning and how what they didn't include has been a problem. Is there anything? How do you know if you don't have this record? Also, is there anything you can say to back that up, the concerns about the questioning and what they didn't include? And then one last question: have you investigated whether these civil charges would be a new standard for impeachment in New York, and if it meets the standard or creates a new standard?
Paul, I think you can probably address your experience having represented a number of chamber employees with how the interviews were conducted.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say in response to your question is, between Mitra's and my law firms, we probably represented 18 or 20 individuals who were interviewed by members of the Attorney General's investigative team. And what I would say is a number of those individuals left those interviews feeling as if the questions were framed in a way to push them to particular conclusions about people, if about the work environment and so forth, that some of the questioning was not sufficiently open-ended in a type of investigation that would be looking for whatever information people had to provide. But I think the truth is, not having seen any of the transcripts and given the Attorney General's investigators' direction to everyone that they were not to disclose to anyone else what they had testified about, I think that the best way for you to see that, the best way for us to see that, is to get the transcripts and see how those interviews were conducted. I think they certainly were all transcribed, and I gather that most or all of them were also videotaped.
Actually, I want to speak to that point, Paul. There were 179 interviews conducted. That's what is reflected in their report. But what they also noted, that only 41 of them were done under oath. What I understand that to mean, and again, ask the Attorney General investigators here, is that the vast majority of the interviews were not transcribed. That people came in and did what they call informal interviews, where there's no court reporter taking down the questions and the answers. And all you have from those interviews would be the investigators taking notes and writing up a memo of what was said. What I have been told is that a lot of interviews of current and former chamber employees were done informally. So we don't have the Q&As that we do for the 41 under oath. And again, I'm sure the investigators will correct me if I'm wrong, but that there was a number of interviews, including the one where this lawyer called me, that the two lead investigators didn't even attend, Mr. Kim and Ms. Clark. They had underlings do it. And I think this begs the question of what they chose to put in the memos, which I assume they did and did not, and whether we're going to get an accurate recitation versus having done all of the interviews with a court reporter there in a Q&A. I am also aware—
They had attorneys, right? They had attorneys present? Were objections raised?
They had attorneys present, but you're not gonna get a Q&A transcript. You're gonna get people's notes, and those attorneys' notes, I can tell you that they will probably say that they were work product.
But there were no objections raised at the time on the record?
I don't know because we were not told every person that was interviewed. We still don't know every person that was interviewed to date.
Question comes from Sonia McGee of CNN. Ms. McGee, your line is now open.
Hi, just getting back to the state trooper again. First of all, is she still assigned to protect the governor? What's being done to protect her and others who have spoken out with these claims against the governor, against potential retaliation? And then my other question, just about your, sort of log of the day of the executive assistant. Is it possible that the executive assistant could have come on another day that just wasn't reflected in the log? What is the mechanism used to log people coming and going from the executive mansion?
So yeah, let me hit the trooper question. I don't know currently now, since the report was released, but what I can tell you is up until a day or two before the report, the trooper was working. And I would also add that the governor has a view of this particular trooper, that's positive in terms of her job and day-to-day. With respect to what's being done about, retaliation, look, the whole world is watching right now. People are not going to be retaliated against by Governor Cuomo. But what we have to be able to do is examine evidence and be able to make a case for our client. Otherwise, to the extent that the assembly wants to move forward, to the extent they want to move forward with impeachment, you now have an impossible standard for us because we're not given access to the evidence. Now, I understand records have been provided to the assembly. We have asked them for that so that we can make an informed submission that adequately addresses the evidence and can point out areas where we believe there's been omissions or exculpatory evidence. I do also want to make another point on this, is that there are points in the report that talk about other chamber employees that believed a complainant. I do know and have been told by some other attorneys that they provided information that undermined the credibility of at least one complainant and questioned the motives. And somehow none of that made it in the report.
Well,
with respect, I'm sorry, I left out one other point. You asked, could it be another day in November? Because this assistant said it happened in November. We have looked at the records of visits to the mansion and we did not find another day in November. We're not aware of another day in November other than the 16th that she was there.
Your personal attorney for the governor, are you saying to me right now that you do not know whether or not one of the women who has accused the governor, who is, you know, presumably still part of his protective detail, you don't know if she's still near him every day on a day-to-day basis? Because I have reporting that she is no longer on his protective detail. And I just want to know, was she moved because, was it her request? Was it the governor's request?
I actually don't know. What you're telling me right now, I didn't know. That's new news. And I actually can talk to my client about it. I do know that shortly before the report, she was still on the detail. I haven't gotten any current information in the last several days. So I don't know.
Your next question comes from Luis Ferrer of the New York Times. Mr. Ferrer, your line is now open.
Hi there. So I have two questions. One is that the report has a footnote that says that the executive assistant number one didn't remember the exact date that the incident happened, but that it was around when she took a photograph on November 16. I just wanted to ask what you made of that. And secondly, what happens after you submit your evidence to the Assembly's Judiciary Committee? Is there some sort of process laid out before the assembly considers drafting articles of impeachment in which, you know, the governor or the executive member gets to testify before the committee or its investigators or anything along those lines?
Yep. Let me take the first question. In that particular footnote of the report, what the investigator said is that they were able to pinpoint what day it was because the assistant had said that her task at the mansion was to photograph a document while she was there. And so they were able to locate the photograph she was, and that photograph was dated November 16th. And the mansion records reflect that that was the day she was there for 3 hours. And we have not seen evidence of another day in November that she was at the mansion. Second, with respect to the assembly process, I certainly hope there is a process, because we did not get that process in this report. We didn't get any process in the report. And so I think that the Assembly Judiciary Committee, they have said that they would do their own review. And I do know that Mr. Hasty had said that they may not just take the report at face value. Well, they shouldn't, because there are things that are omitted. And there are things that just we believe are wrong. And that's why this needs to have a fuller and fairer process that has not been provided to the governor.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take one more.
One more.
Yeah.
Your next question comes from Jennifer Andrus of WNYT-TV. Ms. Andrus, your line is now open. You gonna mute your microphone, Ms. Andrus.
Okay, that should be better. And clearly, this is not Jennifer Andrus. My name is Dan Levy. I am with News Channel 13. And thank you for the opportunity here. Over the last 5 months since the investigation began, many people were willing to give the governor the benefit of the doubt. But since the Attorney General's report was released earlier this week, it seems that clearly much of that support has dried up. And many of the lawmakers who would serve as jurors should there be a trial have already released public statements critical of the governor's behavior. So how do you overcome something like that? How concerned are you?
I think it is always concerning when people announce where they're coming out before they have all the facts. You can't prejudge this. And I am guessing that members of the Assembly and the Senate did not know some of the things that we've shared today. And I hope that would give them pause as jurors. Look, my experience, I'm a trial lawyer. I've tried a lot of cases in front of juries. And the reason I love what I do and the process around it is because I love the rule of law. Because you get to tell both sides. When a witness says that someone did something, I get to ask them questions and cross-examine them. That has not happened here. And for the majority of the witnesses that were interviewed, they were not transcribed. The governor deserves to be treated fairly, like anybody else in this country accused of something. He is 63 years old. He has spent 40 years in public life. And for him to all of a sudden be accused of a sexual assault of an executive assistant that he really doesn't know, doesn't pass muster. He needs to be treated fairly. And this would become, if you accept this report as is, without giving him the evidence, I tell you that is an irresponsible and a new standard for impeachment. Thank you, everybody.